It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can listen to all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you'll rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with your friends if you like it. Today, we had an opportunity for a bonus conversation with Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, about a number of different topics: the baby formula crisis, funding for the war effort in Ukraine, a number of different issues related to the future of the Republican coalition and the party, and how they have a relationship going forward with corporate America in a time of increasing big business wokeness. Marco Rubio from Florida, coming up next.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Senator Marco Rubio, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start with a question about some of the lessons you've taken from the last couple of weeks of debate regarding this baby formula issue that has been on the minds of so many parents across the country. There's something that I see online quite a bit, which is basically along the lines of, why are we sending so much money overseas to Ukraine when families here at home can't even buy baby formula? Obviously, it's a complicated regulatory issue, but what do you say in response to those types of concerns expressed by a lot of people that the focus of Washington is less on Americans' needs and more on needs overseas?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I understand how they feel that way, and I don't think we can just keep writing $1 billion, you know, expenditures to anything overseas. We have a significant amount of things we need to take care of in our country. The analogy I use is, you know, when you get on an airplane and they tell you that if the oxygen masks deploy, first put on your own mask and then put on your child's. I think the reason is if you pass out, you won't be able to help anybody, much less your own child. So I think there's some of that here embedded. I will say that although it's called the Ukraine support bill, a substantial amount of that money is frankly to buy the weapons that we gave them. So we give them Stinger missiles. Now we don't have those anymore and we need them. So we got to go out and buy them, right? So if I lend you something and you use it, I don't have it anymore unless I spend money to buy it back. So that's a big chunk of it. There's money in there to reopen our embassy. What happens is that when you close an embassy in any country because you think the Russians are going to take over Kyiv, you have to destroy everything in there, all the equipment, all the computers. You don't want your Russians getting a hold of that stuff. So now you got to move back in. You got to rebuild it. And part of that money is involved as well in buying up bulk supplies of food because we're going to have a food crisis around the world. And here's why that matters to the United States. When people are starving in other countries, it'll raise our prices too, but they take off. They either overthrow their government, meaning some radical group could take over, you know, Hezbollah, for example, in Lebanon, or if Egypt's overthrown by radicals or something like that. These are countries that are very vulnerable. And at the same time, migratory patterns. We have countries in the Western Hemisphere that could face food shortages. And if they do, you're just going to see the number of people trying to get into our country climb exponentially. So I'm not sure $40 billion is the right number. We probably could have done it with a little bit less. There was a lot of really bad stuff that was taken out of it. Now, you pivot over to the baby formula problem. The key is, irrespective of Ukraine, this bill that the House is pursuing to spend, I think it's $20 million through the FDA, isn't going to solve the baby formula crisis. Because the baby formula crisis is not that there's no money out there to buy it. The baby formula crisis is there isn't anything to buy. It's not being made because they shut down a factory in December. because two babies died, and then they didn't reopen it. It took too long to reopen, and the government basically said, yeah, we'll shut you down. That's what the FDA makes you do, obviously. But no one was keeping an eye on, when are you going to restart? Because if you don't restart, or someone doesn't restart, it's going to lead to a crisis. When the company that makes over half the baby formula in the country shuts down its major manufacturing facility, how could you not know that at some point it was going to lead to a shortage that is going to be severe? And so it really chalks up to incompetence. So it's not a demand issue, which is when you pour more money into the economy. It's a supply issue. And a week ago, I asked the president to invoke the Defense Production Act, and he finally did it yesterday, 6 days later. That's something that should have been done last week, frankly, should have been done months ago.
You know, one of the things that obviously factors into that is the restrictions that are put in place through our trade policy in mind of protecting American dairy farmers, but also there are certain regulations that are in place here that really prevent the import of a lot of European formula, things that people are now trying to even engage in black market purchases in order to buy out of concern that they're going to run out and not be able to feed their children. Is there an overall lesson that you take away from this about trying to create more competition within this market, about potentially reforming WIC or engaging in some other approach in the future that could prevent crises along these lines?
Well, you know, the basic ingredients that go into developing these formulas are not scarce. And so it really comes down to, you have a market share of over 50% embedded in one company, and there really at that point seems to not have been any sort of market decision as to why. It's not even clear that European exporters would have wanted to enter a market that was so, you know, already clearly dominated by one company. I mean, over time, that could be the case. Now, we do have the authority and the ability to lift those trade restrictions, and I most certainly think that's something that should have been a part of the solution. I mean, here's as simple as this. If you're competent and you know what you're doing, you're sitting there and you're saying, okay, the company that makes half the baby formula is offline. At some point, unless they restart pretty quickly, we're going to have a shortage. Let's start working on this now so we don't have a shortage. And I mean now, meaning January, February of this year, when they were distracted voting on all kinds of messaging things up here, and when the Biden administration was more focused on calling everyone who didn't want a takeover of election laws, comparing them to Jim Crow supporters, as opposed to focusing on a real problem like this issue. So is there room for competition? Look, I think our number one challenge when it comes to trade, when it comes to cheating in trade, is China. It's China 1, 2, and 3, and then everybody else. Is there unfairness in some of the arrangements that exist with Europe? Yes, but no country in Europe or Europe collectively is trying to displace America as their military ally, and they're not trying to displace America's place in the world and sort of become dominant at our expense. So I think they're in two very different categories. I think when it comes to China and dependence on China, there's one set of things that we need to consider doing in the national interest. When it comes to countries in Europe, if things are unfair, we should address them, but I don't think that we necessarily need to get into trade wars or have unnecessary barriers to entry on all sorts of things. It extends to like sunscreen. Some of the best sunscreens in the world are in Europe, but you can't import them into the United States because of FDA regulations and things of that nature. So there's a lot of talk about in that field. So the answer is it depends where it's coming from. But if it's coming from an ally, it's a lot less harmful than if it's coming from a place like China, which is not the case on formula.
So you've raised the issue of China. There's a number of critics of war funding when it comes to Ukraine who've basically used this argument that, you know, China's the real threat here. We're getting too distracted by the Ukraine conflict, et cetera. Personally, that's not an argument that I believe in. But let me ask this question of you. In terms of the lessons taken away from Ukraine that could be applied to the China situation as it relates to Taiwan, what are some of the key lessons that you believe ought to be learned by the American people and by political leaders about what needs to be done now in order to prevent the kind of incursion into Taiwan that a lot of experts believe is inevitable, and building up their defense capacity and also sending a message to the Taiwanese about the need for them, like the Ukrainians, to fight for themselves?
Yeah, that's a really good question. On the first point, I would say I agree with the people that say our focus should be primarily on China, and I don't think we can allow ourselves to be distracted into this long, protracted engagement, frankly, for a Russia that at this point and for the foreseeable future is in no shape to invade anyone. have their hands full as it is in Ukraine, and they suffered devastating losses there. That said, I would tell you that if we gave, just using an example, if we gave Ukraine 10 Stinger missiles from our stockpiles, that's 10 less Stinger missiles that we have. So someone's going to have to pay for us to restock, otherwise we're not going to have them in the future if we might need them against someone, God forbid, like China. In the case of the pivot point and the focus on it, I think here's a couple lessons. The first is, and this is a, I think, well-informed opinion of mine, there's probably a divide in China between their military leaders who don't know what it's like to go to war and how painful and costly it is and have all these new toys and are feeling big about themselves, and their political leadership and the Communist Party that's sort of more cautious because they frankly feel like, maybe we're not ready to invade Taiwan yet because we could lose and that would be the end of our rule. So I think that we need to continue to ensure that those doubts are in place. And the way you do that is, A, do we have the military capability to counter what China is doing? Their goal is to make it impossible for us to intervene, right? If they've got these anti-ship missiles that cost a fraction of what an aircraft carrier does but kill aircraft carriers, they're calculating America's not going to lose two very expensive aircraft carriers defending Taiwan. We've got to have counters to those things because if they know we can't intervene, that's a green light to go. And so that's the first thing we have to really focus on. The second is the lesson. The lesson, there's two lessons. The first is in Ukraine, if the West and the United States is not capable of responding to an invasion of Ukraine by a country that we really aren't dependent on for anything, how in the world are we going to intervene or do anything if they go after Taiwan? They're watching to see what the reaction is, because if the reaction against Russia, which is much weaker power than China, is not strong, it's going to be a lot less strong when it comes to China. And the other is, for Taiwan, the lesson is you don't need to match the Chinese Air Force and Navy. What you need to do is make it very painful for them to ever invade you. You have to have the capability to turn into a porcupine. A porcupine, the reason why porcupines don't get eaten in the wild is because they are painful to chew on and difficult to swallow. And that's what Taiwan needs to become, a very costly and expensive place to take. And that's the kind of assistance we should be providing them, understanding that it's an island. So it's not like there's no land border we're going to be able to drive things across. They're going to have the capability to hold on for a substantial period of time until assistance can come on their behalf. All of those things go into the risk calculus that Chinese leaders will make before deciding that they want to militarily take Taiwan.
How confident are you that these are the types of conversations that are happening within the current leadership of the Biden administration, given that the critique that I hear from so many conservatives is that what we're seeing is kind of the B and C team of the Obama years raised perhaps beyond the level that they're prepared to handle?
Well, I think there are some people that are making this argument, and I think that's being balanced by people that are saying, A, China's somebody we need to do a climate deal with, so we really shouldn't be getting antagonistic. B, people that have hopes of returning to the corporate sector after their service in government, after this revolving door spits them back out, and they want to make themselves valuable to companies that will want to send them to China to cut business deals or be engaged in business deals and things of that nature. I think one of the things that's being revealed more these days is how vulnerable, how much corporate America is, how much leverage the Chinese Communist Party has over corporate America. It's a huge market. No CEO wants to have to explain to shareholders why their profits are down because they got kicked out of the most populous nation on earth. And even though they may have a very small piece of that market over there, it's a lot of money for them, and it makes them look good in their quarterly earnings reports to their shareholders. And there are people in government that frankly want to go back and work in that sector. And so I think there's a lot of voices in the Biden administration that just don't get that part of it right. And then there's also a lot of Eurocentric thinking, right? There's still a lot of people who are born into and raised in the post-Cold War foreign policy mentality of it's still about Europe, it's still about the Middle East and counterterrorism, important topics, no doubt, who yet have not fully embraced, have no expertise in, or just are never going to be convinced that the real challenge in the long term is this great power competition with an adversary in China that's unlike any adversary the U.S. has ever confronted.
I want to ask you a couple of questions as a Florida man about some other Florida men. Ron DeSantis, obviously, is someone who has taken on a corporate entity that is very beholden to China currently in the Walt Disney Corporation, something that's raised a lot of controversy and certainly opened the conversation about how Republicans are relating to big business in an era of woke corporations that seem to be increasingly taking their cues from their comms departments or from younger staffers or from people who want them to be more politically active in areas they historically have not participated. What are your thoughts on that dynamic, and what can be done at the federal level along these lines that can push back or send signals on this culture war battle that we see playing out that maybe has corporations thinking twice about engaging in very activist leftist politics?
Yeah. So for most of these corporations, I believe what happens is because they make a lot of money, they are targets of the socialist left. And so the way you, just like you pay protection money to the mob, the protection money they pay to the left-wing mob is A, they donate to groups like Black Lives Matter, who then end up siphoning it off for their personal use. It's a complete, total scam group. Or B, they take on these social causes. That's to sort of say, yeah, we know we make a lot of money, but socialists don't come after us because we're paying our protection money by taking on these social issues and showing how responsible we are. So that's part of the challenge. Part of the challenge, frankly, is that some of the people who lead these organizations have are well-schooled in years of elite education, probably really expensive prep schools, followed by double Ivy and education, where they've basically been indoctrinated in all this. And then they live in communities where they're surrounded by people that believe all this stuff. And they want to make sure they keep getting invited to the right clubs, the right parties, the right social gatherings in the Hamptons and elsewhere in California and places like that. In the case of Disney, here's what's interesting. This issue, this bill, as I hope most people now understand, and I think the overwhelming majority of Americans and Floridians agree with, it's very simple. It says you can't teach kids from the ages of 5 to 9 about sexual identity and gender identity. Just don't talk to them about it in schools. It's not an age-appropriate thing. If there's going to be a conversation about it at that age, it should be their parents and their families that have it. That's what the bill says. Who could disagree with the fact that six-year-olds should not be indoctrinated, or I should say in many cases really confused and battered by these gender conversations when they're still trying to figure out how to color between the lines and read and write and do math? Somehow, it has nothing to do with Disney. Nothing. Disney doesn't run schools, doesn't teach 5 to 9-year-olds, certainly not on a mass scale or anywhere that I know, yet they decided to inject themselves. There are plenty of them. Universal Studios didn't, SeaWorld didn't, all the theme parks we have didn't, but they did for some reason, and I think it's because their employees in California went nuts. So they decided to inject themselves into the middle of this. And how they injected themselves is, A, by lying about the Florida law, and in the process, by smearing a state that has provided them extraordinary benefit. And this special status that they have, they basically use their corporate power to tell the world Florida is a transphobic, homophobic state led by transphobic, homophobic leaders. That's a lie. It's smearing the state. And so the state says, well, if you're going to harm the state, then why should you have a special arrangement that no other theme park and no other business in Florida has, which is their own form of self-government? And I think that's why Governor DeSantis and the legislature took the steps they took. We'll see how that plays out, obviously, because it doesn't take effect until next year. But I think the broader message is they certainly have a right to opine, corporations do. And it's funny, the same people who are at the Supreme Court arguing or hoping were arguing years ago that corporations should not be allowed to participate monetarily in the political environment have no problem whatsoever when corporations use their corporate power to speak out on behalf or get involved on behalf of issues that they care about. And that's writ large across the board. So I think for Republicans, it's pretty simple. These guys always come to us when they want some regulation lowered or some tax code lowered. But on everything else, they basically spend all their time boycotting our states because of the decisions our state elected legislators make, or attacking us in some cases, interfering with us. And right now, Google, if you are on Marco Rubio, if you signed up for MarcoRubio.com in my campaign, and I send you an email and you have a Gmail account, sometimes 100%, not 90, not 80, 100% of the Gmail accounts that follow me are going into spam boxes or disappearing. And somehow Google says, well, that's nothing deliberate. I mean, they have no problem interfering. And that's not just me. It's happening across the Republican ecosystem. It's an outrage. They do it every day. They can get away with it.
Rick Scott's proposal has obviously raised a number of hackles. The White House has used it to hit Republicans. I'm not as much sort of asking you a question about his positioning on this, but you are part of a Tea Party wave that a lot of people really wanted to change Washington. They wanted to see a lot of dramatic change happen. And I think a lot of them felt like that didn't happen for a lot of reasons, that it ran into some problems and perhaps reoriented some priorities, but didn't go as far as they would like. Coming up this November, you're going to have another big wave election in all likelihood, one that vaults a lot of new people into Washington in a similar type of wave, potentially. What is the lesson that you took from that experience now, you know, 10, 12 years later, looking at a situation where you want to be able to promise the American people and to your and your voters that you'll deliver on an agenda, that you'll deliver in legislation and in different priorities that are aligned with their values, and that it won't just run up into the skids or sink into the swamp?
Well, a couple things. The first is that I think the Tea Party wave did make a difference because it took the House and put it in Republican hands, and it ultimately laid the groundwork for the Senate. And we know all the terrible things Obama did his first term. We have no idea how many terrible things he would have done in a second term had he retained a majority in the House and Senate. Some of the things we're seeing now could have been in place 10 years ago or 8 years ago or 12 years ago had that not been the case. So I do think that that did have an impact. The second, and it's an interesting dynamic for us, is we're also part of being a conservative, being a Federalist. The belief that the federal government has limited powers, there's certain things the federal government in our Constitution has the power to do, and the rest should be left up to states. Not that these issues don't matter, not that these issues aren't important, but they're better solved at the state level, education, who runs our elections, etc. And so part of the challenge is our system is set up to reflect it. We were founded by men who did not want this country to have a federal government that was that involved, and they created a system that made it very difficult for the federal government to take action. They created a Senate that's very different from the House. You have to have a bill that passes both, signed by a president, passes constitutional muster in the Supreme Court. So it's a place where it's easy to stop things and hard to make things happen, which is why I think you've seen so much power shift to the courts, but also to the administrative monster that is Washington, you know, and the rulemaking. They make a lot of law and so forth. But part of that is it's hard to get things passed and done. And so it's interesting because we had people a couple years ago that wanted us to get rid of the filibuster to do all sorts of things that we wanted. Had we done that, had we gotten rid of the filibuster in the Senate, as an example, and that's not part of the Constitution, it's a Senate rule, but let's just suppose that when we had the House, the Senate, and the White House, we would have gotten rid of the filibuster, we would have passed a bunch of stuff. But now, the Democrats would have passed a bunch of stuff. They would have passed, on top of the $1.9 trillion spending that kickstarted inflation, they would have spent another $3 or $4 trillion had there not been a filibuster. They would have taken over federal elections had there not been a filibuster. They would pack the Supreme Court. Who knows what they would do if they were not limited by that? I can tell you what they're already doing on nominees. They are nominating some of the craziest, zaniest, radical people that have ever served in American government are being appointed by this administration because they can break a tie with the vice president's vote. So I think we have to also understand that being a part of conservatives, being a federalist, and the belief that we have states, states can solve a lot of these issues. It's the right place to have most of these debates. That doesn't mean there aren't things we need to be doing when it comes to foreign policy, trade policy, national security, and broader issues that involve the whole country. But I think that's a perspective to keep in mind. My hope is that what we're going to be electing in these elections are people that understand we're living in a different world now that's going to cause us to reevaluate a lot of the public policy decisions made in the last 20 years, many cases through bipartisan consensus that no longer is applicable to the world we now live in.
You mentioned the issue of federalism, and it's very possible that this court is about to send the issue of abortion back to the states to decide for themselves the various limitations and periods of time, etc., that are appropriate when it comes to abortion. As you look at that battle, one that a lot of pro-lifers like yourself, you know, may have never thought would happen in their lifetime, would see that shift come to pass. What are some of the things that you're thinking about what comes next? Steps that both the federal government can take at your level, but also the battles that are going to happen at the state level, where a lot of Republicans who've been able to check that pro-life box may never have had to actually argue or fight on the issue. What do you anticipate this doing to our politics? And do you think it's going to result in, you know, a mass upheaval like the left is claiming? Or do you think it's something that we will be able to work through the process and solve in a more representative level closer at the state level?
Well, first, let me define, to me, the issue. People say it's the abortion issue. Really, to me, it's not an issue about abortion. It's an issue about life. I get abortion's involved in it, and that's the central question in terms of what policymakers are dealing with. But I have no desire to impose anything on anyone. My desire is to protect human life, to define, you know, if we as the most important principle, I think, behind everything we do in government and, frankly, much of what we do in society is human life has dignity. It needs to be protected. Human life matters. And so we do all kinds of things. Virtually every law we pass is in one way or another a way to either protect human life or improve human life and the dignity of human life in our country and in some cases around the world. I believe that a human being has a right to live irrespective of what stage in its development that human being is in. And that includes from the moment of conception where they're fully human. And they're not fully developed, but they're fully human. Everything that it takes to be a human being is there at the moment of conception. And I think our laws and our policies should reflect that. Now, some people have a different point of view. That's why we have a republic where those debates will happen. We've never had that debate in America. What we had is a Supreme Court that stepped up and said years ago they made up a constitutional right to something and never allowed the country to have that debate. And it'll be a loud debate and it'll be divisive. But these are the kinds of things you have to do in a free society. And so I think the fact that this issue could potentially return to the political realm means for the first time in 50 years, American policymakers and society and the public will have to have a debate about the importance of human life, at what stage do we protect it, and what the laws to do so should look like. We've never had to have that debate before because Roe acted as a buffer against either the left having to justify its position or the right, for that matter, and those who are pro-life and so forth. So as far as what I'm thinking about, I think I want us to be a country that values human dignity and human life, a country that basically says that no child is a tragedy. No human life, maybe the circumstances surrounding it are horrifying, but the human life itself is not a tragedy. And maybe the circumstances around it aren't what you planned, but the human life involved itself is a blessing, not a liability. And then we have to have policies that reflect it. So to be pro-life means we have to also be willing to step up primarily in the societal sector and the private sector, but certainly reflect it in our policies and say, if someone is born into difficult circumstances, we want that person to succeed. We understand that someone who's born into difficult circumstances may need some help in terms of, especially early in their lives and getting to a certain point, and have policies that reflect that. And to ensure that I'm not ever going to say that some 15-year-old girl who's been gotten pregnant and scared and afraid to tell her parents that that's easy. That's not easy. That's a very difficult circumstance. But I also want that 15-year-old girl to know that irrespective of everything else that's going on, there's a human being involved now, a second human being. It's a blessing, not a curse. And we want to be helpful. We want them to know that there are options that will help them bring that human life to term. And more importantly, be supportive, not just say you're on your own. And obviously, I think a lot of that's going on already in the civic space. But we want to make sure our government policies reflect it, not necessarily spending that all the time, but certainly the things that we build up around it.
Let's go out on this. The announcement from Elon Musk the other day that he was kind of fed up with the Democratic Party certainly seemed to attract a lot of attention. I won't ask you to comment on the whole of Elon Musk because I don't think that you could really wrap yourself around the complexity of such a human. But what do you think about the development, the signal that his move ideologically sends, not just for the world of big tech, but kind of the world of innovation and the idea that moving forward, the Republican Party is now a space that perhaps is viewed as a place that is going to be more welcome for potentially contrarian views or people with views that run afoul of the woke left and that overall kind of policing agenda that seems to be turning a lot of contrarian thinkers off.
Yeah, so I think a couple of things. First of all, I hold the Republican Party beyond anything else is defined as the party of common sense. And that's where I think that and that's a term that's thrown around a lot, but there are just things that make sense, right? We learned them from 5,500 years of recorded history. We've learned it from years of our own experience. There are things that we know are true and not true. Now, we had a hearing yesterday in the House here. I saw a clip of it, and some lady was asked, you know, do men get pregnant? And could a man be pregnant? She said, yes, they could. But there's no such recorded instance I will tell you that the moment that happens, we all want to know about it. That would be a pretty major development in human history. And if that were the case, but these people say it with a straight face. We had, the radical abortion bill that the Democrats wanted to vote on last week. The only mention of woman in that bill is in the title. In the whole thing, it's about pregnant persons. And like, so people look at that and say, okay, look, no matter how you feel about abortion, this stuff is silly. Like, you guys are acting stupid when you make us try to believe that things that never existed and aren't true are true. You begin to insult people's intelligence. But the problem is that's seeped into everything. This disinformation, a misinformation board, another example of it. You want to be the party of common sense. You want to be the party of competence. And I always think we're going to be the home of a center-right movement of people that believe that we want a limited federal government, not because we don't care, not about people's challenges, but because we feel to the extent there's a government role in solving many of those problems, that government is the state and local government because they're closer to you and you have more influence over them. And within that umbrella that I just described, I think there's room for a lot of diversity of opinion. There already is. We're the party of Rand Paul and Susan Collins, of Lisa Murkowski and, Ted Cruz. I mean, that's a pretty broad ideological spectrum. The Democratic Party is pretty uniform. You don't see a lot of diversity. And every week that goes by, every primary that happens, more and more of the people joining the Democratic Party are of the far left. I mean, and of the far, far left. And frankly, I just don't think that's where America is.
Senator Rubio, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to join.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Marco Rubio. He's obviously an interesting figure for a number of different reasons. And one of the things that I think we should keep in mind is that his tenure and the tenure of a lot of different people of his generation who came up with the Tea Party wave and everything related to that is going to be very interesting over the coming decade. Look, we are really on the cusp of what could potentially be many years of Republicans being dominant in the Congress in Washington, potentially for the next 4 to 8 years. And this is a point where you might see a shift in leadership away from a generation of leaders like Mitch McConnell, who've been around for quite a while in terms of the Republican Party. Whether someone like Marco Rubio wants to potentially put himself forward as a leader in the Senate really remains to be seen. But for a lot of these people who, took a run at the presidency, had different levels of experience and success, but also, ran into some challenges, they may look at the ground and basically decide they'd rather be leaders within the Senate as opposed to taking another run at national office. At the same time, a lot of them are still young enough that they certainly can make a run for national office, especially when you see someone as old as Joe Biden, who has made it there. The idea that someone, who went through the 2016 experience, that their career is somehow over or that they've run into their limit is really just not something that I believe in. And I'll be interested to see if people like Rubio really try to make a mark by taking over the reins of a Senate that has for a very long time been in the hands of people like Mitch McConnell, of Chuck Schumer, Harry Reid before that, and Bill Frist, Trent Lott, the like. And I think that this is something that really could be an interesting development in terms of redirecting the future of not just the Republican Party, but the future of the Senate as a body. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.